Blog Talk Radio. about Texas Radio and the Big B. Comes out of the Virginia swamps, cool and slow with plenty of precision. And the backbeat narrow and hard to master. Some call it heavenly in its brilliance. Others mean and rueful of the Western dream. I love the friends I have gathered together in this thin raft. We have constructed pyramids in honor of our escaping. This is the land where the Pharaoh died.
To the Dragon's Lair on Renegade Broadcasting, the best source for factual information on the planet. Tonight's show, again, will be about Martin Luther King's scumbag. Hopefully, we can knock the rest of this out in today's show, and we will not have to go into another one. And so today's show is called Paint It Black Continued. And again, it's about Martin Luther King Jr., plagiarist, traitor, communist, criminal, philanderer, womanizer, and overall sleazebag. A beast as a saint. Essentially, I'm destroying a sacred cow. Okay, before we get started here, I want everybody to be sure and give a listen to all the other hosts here on Renegade. I believe until further notice, it's Kyle on Mondays, to be determined, and or wild card Tuesdays with a guest host or a secondary host by one of the regular hosts. on Wednesdays. It's Will. Mike is on Thursdays. Lou is on Fridays. Roundtable is on Saturdays. And me, of course, on Sundays. For the record, today is March 10th, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. Today the sun is at 19 degrees Pisces. And, God damn it, Mercury is still retrograde. Mercury will be retrograde until next Sunday. So it will go direct then, and we only have one more week of this nonsense. However, it takes a few days for things to actually straighten out, so it's a little bit longer than a week. So, as usual, expect delays in communication and general confusion, etc. Additionally, for me, I still have a transiting solar arc Mars conjuncting my natal ascendant, which is the first house, and will for a few weeks to come. I am also now in the beginning of a transiting solar arc Saturn conjuncting my descendant, which is the seventh house cusp. Now, I attempted to do a show on astrology here last Tuesday. It didn't quite go the way I wanted it, but hopefully everybody still got something of value out of it. I will schedule at some point in the near future after Mercury goes direct the show that I wanted to do. And then I will try to fill in some of the blanks on where I didn't go on the last show. I just kind of left some of that information hanging, but it was a good start to give you a general idea on some things. But I have a whole list of other stuff. And I now have all of the audio for those videos loaded for that show. So there we have it. Now I'm going to try and paste here into the chat room a few minutes a link to that Quantum Astrology, since it's not on YouTube. And again, I will not be monitoring the chat. I may glance at it during breaks. Again, I will be drinking my water and smoking where I'm sitting. So occasionally some momentary pauses, you know, and the usual cough and sometimes a hack. The chat room is at renegadebroadcasting.com. I don't know if there's a live feed there tonight or not. Hopefully there is. The other place to go for chat is renegadebroadcasting.chatango.com, or you can go to alternativesocial.com and listen and chat there, as well as post and read if you like. And if you're not a member, why not? Okay, I thought I solved that telephone ringing problem. Apparently not. So disregard this telephone ringing that you hear in the background. All right, I also want to mention, too, a website that everybody needs to go to if they have not gone to. And if you have been there, keep going back. www.nationalprotectionism.com. Again, I have no personal website or blog, and I don't know if I will have one in the future or not. No phone calls tonight. Way too much material to cover. If you would like to contact me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com, and that's magus_18@geocities.com. Subscribe. If you want to subscribe to my e-list, just send me an email that says subscribe. Otherwise, just write me. I can't guarantee I can get back to all of the emails. I will try, though. Now, let me take a drink of water here. I'll try to solve that phone issue during the next break, by the way. Hopefully that won't happen again. I have clients who feel that they can call me pretty much anytime they want. Now, other news. My cat survived the worst of whatever the hell it was that was wrong with her. She is still not with me in the room tonight, though. She's still in the other room. But she is certainly a hell of a lot better, but she has a ways to go to get some of her weight and fat back on her. Now, also, too, I wanted to mention something. You know, the last show in astrology, I brought up the issue that I needed to get back with somebody on some information, and I have not had a chance to get to it. I have a feeling it may be towards the end of the week before I can get to it. This Mercury retrograde is just kicking me in the balls. Okay, before we get going, I'm going to go ahead and play one more song, and we'll get started. And there will be no other topics for this show but this one. And we'll see if we can knock this out. All right. Now, Here's some Crota. Thank you. Okay, I'm back. Now, last week we left off with King having been identified as plagiarizing a significant portion of his doctoral dissertation. Now, I'm going to reread that last paragraph where I left off. King plagiarized a significant portion of his doctoral dissertation. When Boston University formed a committee to determine the amount of plagiarism in King's dissertation, the committee concluded that 45% of the first part and 21% of the second part were copied from other people's works. Despite that outrage, and probably due for the most part to King's popularity among African Americans, Boston University felt that no thought should be given to the revocation of Dr. King's doctoral degree. However, if you or I had done something of that nature, we would have been reprimanded for it and denied the doctoral. How can King be viewed as a leader to today's youth? He only obeyed the laws that he deemed just. He called for black power. He incited riots. King threatened mayors. He wanted preferential treatment for African Americans. He cheated in school and throughout his life. His love extended way beyond his speeches. Some congressmen felt that the type of leadership given by King was not something to be admired. Congressman Wagner felt that King did not deserve the attention he received. In contradiction to the beliefs held by King's misguided followers, Congressman Wagner told the truth behind King's actions. The Washington Star of yesterday, September 20th, 1965, summarized the feeling of those in government and out for the latest bit of meddling by King's, and out for the latest bit of meddling by Martin Luther King Jr. in an editorial, aptly titled Martin Luther King, Go Home. There is a great deal of concern in every quarter of the nation over the role this professional wowser has recently taken upon himself, that of a Secretary of State without portfolio, and I might add, without invitation and without qualifications. King is a meddler and unqualified to tell others how to run either their government or their personal affairs. The fact that he is a Negro gives him the right in the eyes of the deluded liberals to meddle in any affair in which any Negro is involved. Yet the record shows that wherever his presence is felt, there has been bloodshed, strife, and anarchy. His nonviolence has bred violence. His leadership has turned loose the rampaging mob. His peace has fomented hatred at a time when cool heads and reasoning was needed. Now, I believe that ends what I've read before. Let's see here. Let me take another drink of water. Okay, in the later part of March 1968, a month before King's assassination, King decided to visit a garbage collector strike in Memphis, Tennessee. He organized a demonstration that culminated in a riot. After the traditional burning and looted was completed, it was discovered that a 16-year-old was killed in the process. A judge, wishing to prevent more outbursts, put forth a mandate that made certain there would be no more demonstrations. King felt that it was an unjust law and made it perfectly clear that he was not going to obey the law. Had King obeyed America's laws, or had he decided to go home, as some congressmen desired, it is quite probable that the fanatic James Ray would not have eventually killed him. Now, I'm going to interject something here. I'm not going to get into anything outside of this essay on his killer. I'm just going to read this as it is written. I'm not going to even attempt to go that direction. And frankly, I do not care who killed him. It does not matter to me in the least. Okay, back to the essay. It seems an outrage that the American government has named a day after Martin Luther King Jr. For those of us who are still idealistic about the American way of life and truth, justice and honor, it appears that a petition for a redress of grievances is necessary to have that holiday repealed and would be in order. There's little question that the holiday would create was created to appease African Americans. Politicians felt that African Americans should have their own hero, their own day. However, there are so many blacks that have served America well, both in war and in peace, that it seems inappropriate to give King this recognition. As for receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, it appears that this may have been conferred by well-meaning but misguided members of the international community who were either unaware of King's activities in America or had feigned blindness. In response to this apparent contradiction, awarding a peace prize to a man who had caused violence, one fellow stated his feelings regarding the incident, which was printed in the Congressional Record. Quote, "The politicians and government leaders had better stop pampering Mr. King and others like him and begin speaking against those who would bring more violence and lawlessness to our country. It is time for President Johnson to take a hard, tough line with these rabble-rousers who advocate anarchy." Former President Harry Truman stated it well some time ago when someone admonished him for criticizing the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Mr. Truman was reminded that Mr. King had been the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. Mr. Truman responded, "Well, I didn't give it to him." End quote. Cough here a second. Although it may seem that what has already been mentioned would be enough to warrant a repeal of the King holiday, there is one more thing about him that is particularly disturbing that needs to be addressed. King's apparent belief in socialism or communism. It appears that King and other leaders throughout the civil rights movement accepted that belief because they liked the idea of redistributing, the socialist euphemism for stealing other people's property. In order to fully understand the reasoning for this folly, and before delving into King's involvement, it is necessary to take a cursory examination of the tenets of socialism. One particularly disturbing thing about America's past is the socialists and communists who have organized to create their utopia, a place where others work to satisfy the socialist and communist laziness. The communist and socialist utopia is a place where they control the government and decide who works where, at what time, and to be paid how much. The proponents of socialism and its twin brother, communism, have caused many problems in the U.S. and still exist in some places, especially in large cities. Although the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics has practically, for all intents and purposes, crumbled from following the asinine ideology of socialism, that has not stopped the socialist advocates in America from promoting more of the same. For instance, the International Socialist Organization still meets at many universities in the U.S., which it has been doing for quite some time, much like similar groups across the United States. I'm gonna need to clear my throat here. Give me just a second. Okay. Now, hopefully it'll sound a little bit better. And the writer of this states, a couple of years back, I even came across one of the ISO's flyers that represents the International Socialist Organization, which asked people to attend a meeting that was sympathetic towards the African National Congress, which is irrefutably affiliated with South Africa's Communist Party and is described later. I'm presuming he means the SA. Despite the USSR crumbling, the fringe groups who operate in America and who support an ideology similar to that which was formerly embedded within the USSR, often formed by otherwise intelligent people, have stridently advocated more of their ideology. Through its end, results has proven to be detrimental to any nation. The proponents of socialism and communism have never truly understood the work ethic, unless it was to be applied to others, of course. Regarding physical labor, difficult mental labor has always been beneath them. They always complain of what they call the wage slave type of relationship that is forged between worker and employer. The socialist maxim has always been this: you reap what others have planted, not what you sow. Communism and socialism support the empowerment of their ideology through force or, if possible, through gradual changes. In the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics past, the force used by the party resulted in the deaths of approximately 40 to 60 million of their own people. Unfortunately, that estimate was probably not too far off. The killing of people has always been an important part of the socialist ideology. People will not accept communism unless by sheer force. Now, I want to interject something here. If you listen to any of my other presentations, you will recall the method that they go about doing this. They always chop the head off of what's there and put theirs on top. And that the head that's there is the best part of the population. And when I say chop it off, I'm talking about kill, murder. Okay, communism is the complete lack of motivation. What is the purpose of working harder if you will not reap greater rewards? In the USSR, people learned that the harder they worked, the more the socialist leaders would benefit. The people also felt that stealing from a company was acceptable. After all, they reasoned everything is everybody's property. Why not take it? The socialist leadership condemned the so-called burgois. I hope I'm saying that right. I've never really actually bothered to look up how that's pronounced. The people who made the money during their lifetimes through hard work, while the socialist leaders took the profits from them, and in a sense the socialist leadership became the new burgois, which condemned the former. The socialists condemned the capitalists, yet took the rewards from those who produced and created new goods. The socialist leaders claimed to be for the worker, whom they called by the Latin word proletarian. Yet the socialist leaders did everything in their power to keep that very worker in his place by their actions. Or they felt that they knew better than the worker what he wanted, or, for that matter, needed. Socialism was created to trick the working class with pretty slogans and prettier words. It was created to take the wealth of a nation by using and manipulating good-natured workers. Socialism was never intended to help the worker. It was created to feed off of him like some parasitic leech, sucking the lifeblood of the worker until he was of no more use and giving no rewards to the socialist leadership. Communism is the government dictating to you what you will do and what you will not do. It is the government telling you what you can say and what you cannot say. Communism is political correctness at its worst. It was designed to control and manipulate. Although there will never be a nation where its people are completely free, except those where anarchy is prevalent, America has allowed people a significant amount of freedom, which seems a little less by the day, providing that the people do not infringe upon the rights of others. Nowadays, since the so-called Red Scare is over, many people who are outright socialists are incorrectly being labeled and sometimes even call themselves liberals. A liberal is anything but a socialist. A liberal is, basically, an open-minded person who is willing to discuss new ideas to better society. Socialism is not a new idea and has been proven not to better society. The socialists or communists who masquerade as liberals do not care about bettering American society as a whole. They only care about their little groups or their special causes. Most leaders of the so-called socialist causes are in it just for the money or prestige from others. Other people who are incorrectly called and sometimes call themselves liberals support the Bill of Rights, as long as it supports their rights and not those of their adversaries, whether real or imagined. There have been major controversies in the American Civil Liberties Union when some of its members, the people who are actually true liberals, not just those who call themselves by that name, have suggested that the Constitution applies to all people within America, as it does, and not just this or that group. The pseudo-liberals have suggested that anything which contradicts their beliefs is not to be heard. America's communists, socialists, and other subversives have brought about changes to take away certain rights from people that have assisted this nation in its spiral downwards. In order to take away those rights, the freedom and rights that have been created in the U.S., the people who advocate communism or its twin brother socialism have had to use sheer trickery. It is by the same trickery that communist and socialist organizations have created deceptive names in order to camouflage their innermost desires. Very few communist or socialist organizations that have existed in the U.S. are as open about their beliefs to actually use the words socialist or communist. Oddly enough, some of the people who were socialists or communists are revered in today's society, although most of them have become obscure or forgotten. Let us examine these people who have been operating in America for some time and their deceptive measures. In the year 1938, several people, James Dombrowski, Aubrey Williams, Carl Braden, and Ann Braden, were busy at work in the United States. For instance, James Dombrowski was working as the administrator of the Southern Conference for Human Welfare, that's SCHW. That sounds like an honorable organization. Everyone likes the idea of helping people, that is, human welfare. In some places in the South, and in the North for that matter, are definitely in need of it. Oftentimes, things are not quite as good as they sound. It turns out that the SCHW was a communist front. Paul Crouch, an admitted communist from 1925 to 1942, who was one of the founders of the SCHW, identified the purpose of the organization before the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee. The SCHW, said Crouch, was intended to lead to class hatred and race hatred, dividing class against class and race against race. The Senate Internal Security Subcommittee voiced similar findings. The SCHW was conceived, financed, and set up by the Communist Party in 1938 to promote communism in the southern states. The communists who formed the SCHW realized their mistake. They needed to do something to get rid of the bad image that their organization had from the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee. They decided upon a simple solution, simply to change the SCHW's name. They decided to call it the Southern Conference Educational Fund, SCEF. Well, that sounds good. After all, everyone is for funding education. There are schools in the South that could use a bit more money. The communists always did have a knack for disguising their evil intentions. They changed the name of their outfit, but not much else. Their address, publication, and phone number, along with most of the officers, remained the same. Dombrowski continued to work as the administrator of this new organization, the SCEF. Board member Aubrey Williams and field secretaries Carl and Ann Braden, all of whom were identified as communists, continued to serve the SCHW with this new name, the SCEF. The Senate Internal Security Subcommittee eventually called the SCEF what it was, a communist transmission belt for the South. It is not too surprising to discover that when on October 5, 1963, the local and state police raided the SCEF offices in New Orleans, quantities of communist literature were seized. The SCEF was notorious for its communist affiliation. The Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who was one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s African-American friends, became the head of the SCEF. Apparently, he had qualifications that the SCEF wanted, a former convict. Later, Shuttlesworth formed the Montgomery Improvement Association, also known as MIA, which King led during the boycott of buses in Alabama. There was one more person involved with the SCEF who deserves particular attention, namely Martin Luther King Jr. King spoke for the New York Friends of the Southern Conference Education Fund. When people wanted to see the conference, they were told to make reservations through William Howard Milish, who was identified by government informant Louis Bundes as a communist. That in itself is hardly worth mentioning, but the story does not end there. Pay close attention now. Now I'm going to clear my throat again. There were other organizations in America that were similar to the SCEF. The Highlander Folk School shares a legacy similar to that of the SCEF. Both organizations were formed from other organizations that were previously cited by the government as being communist organizations. Those commies, they always were the clever ones at playing musical chairs, moving to different locations, changing the names of their organizations whenever someone turned over the rock. In 1932, James Dombrowski, the same fellow who was responsible for the formation of the SCHW and SCEF, and Miles Horton, both of whom were self-admitting communists, formed the Commonwealth College in Mena, Arkansas. Eventually, the government discovered that the organization was communist. The sickle and hammer flag, which was prominently displayed, gave the communists away. The Attorney General said the Commonwealth College was a communist front and fined it $2,500 for violating the sedition statute of the state of Arkansas. The faculty of the Commonwealth College decided it was time to move on down the road. They packed up their bags and moved to Monteagle, Tennessee, and formed the Highlander Folk School. Besides the communists Horton and Dombrowski, there were a few other communists who worked at the Highlander. For instance, Don West, who was the district director of the Communist Party from North Carolina, and Aubrey Williams, an identified communist, participated in the school's operation. Aubrey Williams has an interesting history. Much like Shuttleworth, Williams was president of the SCEF at one time, too. In 1963, he became chairman of the National Committee to Abolish the House Committee on Un-American Activities, also known as NCAHCUA. I'm just going to say Un-American Committee of Un-American Activities. Our American government at one time had an organization called the House Committee on Un-American Activities, which investigated, simply put, Un-American Activities. The people who formed this newer version of that probably thought that it was amusing to form an organization to abolish the former organization, which was investigating the subversive activities of some of the members of the newer organization. The American government did not think that was too funny. The Committee to Abolish the House Committee on Un-American Activities was cited for what it was called a communist front. Martin Luther King Jr. was associated with the National Committee to Abolish the House Committee on Un-American Activities. Obviously, the Highlander Folk School was one of those schools that gave its students a special kind of education. With James Dombrowski and his collaborators, Miles Horton, Don West, and Aubrey Williams, they decided to help educate the people of Tennessee. Although some people in Tennessee may have needed an education, there appeared to be an ulterior motive for the education given by the Highlander Folk School. Subjects like English and math were not even taught there, which might make you wonder what was taught at that school. Well, there were some well-known people who attended the Highlander Folk School and either received or gave the students their special attention. For example, Rosa Parks, the African-American woman who started all the controversy surrounding the busing boycott mentioned in the earlier part of this essay, just happened to go there as well. She attended the Highlander Folk School for a considerable period of time and received the education offered by that school. It appears that the busing system incident had some interesting characters working behind the scenes. The busing incident helped pave the way for the preferential treatment that African Americans receive today. Under the rallying banner of communism, the adherents fought for special treatment for African Americans. That is what communism has always meant, namely, people given things that they would not normally merit by their own capabilities. There is no doubt there were ulterior motives for the protest. Of course, Rosa Parks, the former secretary for the NAACP, denied any plans, which were probably discussed in intricate detail at the Highlander, about why the Montgomery bus boycott was formed. Quote, I don't really know why I wouldn't move, said Rosa Parks. There was no plot or plan at all. Could Rosa have been lying? Could there have been a plot or a plan? Let us take a look at the past history of the Highlander Folk School, which she attended. Horton, West, Williams, Dombrowski, all non-communists, were involved with the Highlander Folk School. And, of course, Rosa Parks had attended the Highlander as well. Guess who else was involved with the Highlander Folk School? Martin Luther King, Jr. His name just keeps popping up. King gave a speech at the Highlander Folk School in 1957. On March 28, 1965, when asked by Lawrence Spivack on the television show Meet the Press about the incident, King admitted that he was there and made a 45-minute speech. Of course, it would not have done him too much good to deny his association with the school, since a photograph of him was taken while he was there. Why would Martin Luther King Jr. be at the Highlander Folk School? Remember the incidents from when we discussed earlier about conquering the castles? I believe that had to do with, if I remember correctly, that was about the issue in Chicago on the tenement. One of Martin Luther King Jr.'s aides said compensatory preferences were to be given to blacks, and King said that he wanted only black bus drivers for predominantly black routes. The Highlander Folk School, like many communist organizations operating throughout the U.S., supported these objectives. In the picture taken at the Highlander, which was shown in the now defunct Georgia newspaper Augusta Courier, King is sitting next to Aubrey Williams, president of the Southern Conference Education Fund, Inc. Next to Aubrey Williams is Miles Horton, described by the Augusta Courier as the director of Highlander Folk School for Communist Training. While King spoke before the assemblage at the Highlander, he said that he admired Horton's noble purpose and creative work. Horton made a form letter for the Highlander, dated May 15, 1963, on which King is listed as a sponsor of the Highlander Folk School. That should not be too surprising, since King had announced before that his SCLC and the Highlander Folk School would be joining forces. Seated behind King, Williams and Horton in the picture, is Abner W. Berry of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. Abner W. Berry was also a writer for the communist publication called The Daily Worker. And, of course, dear Rosa Parks, the lady who was involved in the busing incident, was in the group photo as well. While on the television program Meet the Press, Spivack showed King the photograph taken at the Highlander Folk School. Spivack asked King about the photograph, which had the caption, "Martin Luther King Jr. at Communist Training School." And then he asked him, "Will you tell us whether that was a communist training school and what you were doing there?" King responded, quote, "Well, I don't think it was a communist training school. In fact, I don't know it wasn't. In fact, I know it wasn't. The Highlander Folk School, which was referred to in that particular article, was a school that pioneered in bringing Negroes and whites together at a time when it was very unpopular to train them for leadership all over the South. And I think they did an able job in doing it." Close quote. King then went on to cite some respectable people who he claimed supported the Highlander Folk School, for instance, Eleanor Roosevelt. Although King did not offer any proof to substantiate his claim that former President Franklin Roosevelt's wife supported the Highlander Folk School, a school which was seemingly intent on replacing the U.S. government with its own form of government and training its students for leadership all over the South, that did not stop King from suggesting that she supported it. By associating the former president's wife with the Highlander, true whether true or not true, making it appear as if it was a reputable organization. King was trying to disguise his nefarious alliances at the Highlander, even on the slim chance that the late President Roosevelt's wife did, in fact, support the Highlander Folk School. A very slim chance indeed. Actually, I disagree. That does not mean anything other than she was probably unaware of its activities. She was not a politician and did not have any special knowledge of subversive groups. Not likely. However, King's affiliation with the Highlander and his organizers were not involved. And its organizers were too involved to neglect. Dr. Alfred Jarrett, the author of The Negro in Politics and an educational advisor to Harlem Youth Activities Unlimited, suggested that King has been used as a tool of the Communist Party in several instances. Jarrett was almost right. King had not been used. On numerous occasions, King had associated with subversive and communist organizations. Occasionally, he liked to do his friends a favor. So every once in a while, he would take some money off their hands, say a few good words about them, make a speech in support of their beliefs, and do other nice things that friends do for one another. Many high-ranking members of King's various groups were outright self-admitting communists. They acted as King's advisors. Some were particularly subversive and had anti-American intentions. Bayard Rustin was one of King's colleagues and had worked underneath King in the Montgomery Improvement Association for a considerable period of time. Rustin was described by King as a good black leader and a brilliant, efficient, and dedicated organizer and one of the best and most persuasive interpreters of nonviolence. Rustin certainly had the qualifications to work for King. Bayard Rustin's qualifications are better documented in the public record in that he was reported in the press to have been a member of the Young Communist League, said Senator Strom Thurmond, Republican of South Carolina. Rustin maintained membership in the Young Communist League in 1936, which he attended college in New York, New York. In 1941, Rustin allegedly quit the Young Communist League and or graduated from it, but continued to engage in suspicious activities. During World War II, Rustin served 26 months in federal prisons for draft dodging and advocating resistance to the war. He was also arrested for sexual perversion. Arrest record number 33914 in Pasadena, California, and went to jail after he admitted to being guilty in 1953. Rustin certainly seemed to have the right qualifications for the Montgomery Improvement Association, or MIA. Rustin's qualifications for the MIA did not end there. He also associated with the following: War Resisters League, World Peace Brigade, the magazine called Liberation, Medical Aid to Cuba Committee, Committee for Nonviolent Action, Greenwich Village Peace Center, and other similar organizations. It is amusing how the socialist communist organizations use nice-sounding titles, names oftentimes filled with such honorable things as peace, Christian, etc., in a deceptive manner to make their organizations appear holier than thou. Rustin did have his finer points. For instance, he was for education. Unfortunately, the education that he promoted, much like the Highlander Folk School, was socialist education. It turned out that he was active in the American Forum for Socialist Education, a group that was determined to be communist dominated by the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee that was determined to be communist dominated by the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee. I just wanted to restate that because I don't think I said it properly. Okay, I'm going to stop for a second and give my voice a little bit of a break. And we're going to play a song. We'll be back in just a second. I've got a little treat for you. Here's a rare recording. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
And that was a rare recording of the electric blues master Johnny Winter from Beaumont, Texas. Some of my cousins grew up with Edgar and Johnny and actually did know them. Another local talent from that area is Janis Joplin. She grew up in Port Neches, just right next door. So anyway, where was I? I kind of got lost in the chat there for a second. Okay, back to this essay. Could Rustin cleaned up his act by the time he met King and served as King's secretary and advisor in 1955? Everyone makes a mistake now and then in his youth. Everyone should have a chance to redeem himself. But some communists never learn. Rustin's activities were consistent from his youth to his old age. Rustin kept busy with his subversive activities. Rustin attended the 16th National Convention of the Communist Party in 1957 as he claimed to be an observer. All of the people who attend the event were observing it as well. On occasion, he visited and was entertained at the Soviet embassy. He even went to Russia in 1958, which was sponsored by the Nonviolent Action Committee Against Nuclear Weapons. On February 4, 1964, Rustin was photographed while he was leaving a party at the Soviet mission to the United Nations. According to the January 1963 edition of Fellowship, that's a magazine, I think, cited in the Congressional Record, Rustin reported to be a friend of Kwame Nkrumah, some African name. I'm just going to use his first name. Kwame just happened to be the former communist director of Ghana, which is, by the way, on the west coast of Africa near Nigeria. And by the way, on the subject of Ghana, you know, there's a lot of scammers that operate out of Nigeria and Ghana that will try to rip you off for money, and their sole reason is to get even for slavery. And of course, they're ignorant of who actually it was that actually enslaved them. So anyway, back to the essay. Rustin is credited with having helped establish a Center for Nonviolence at Dar es Salaam, Tanganyika. It was hardly a center for nonviolence. It was proven to be a training center for communist guerrillas, and people who attended there had, on several occasions, conducted raids in other nations. Rustin did not seem to care too much for the African Americans whom he claimed to represent. In a speech he gave while at Richmond, Virginia in September of 1963, his communist rhetoric was readily shown. He said more bloody Negro suffering should be encouraged so that squeamish northern Negroes would be horrified into line. On another occasion, Rustin said there was only one hope for blacks in America: go left. It is not too surprising to discover that Rustin, by his own admission, was an organizer of the Communist Party, USA, for 12 years. In 1960, after 5 years of diligent work for King, Rustin was replaced as King's secretary and advisor by Hunter Pitts Odell, a.k.a. Jack Odell. Odell was more red than a redneck's neck on a hot Mississippi afternoon. In other words, he was an outspoken communist. King seemed to enjoy having those type of people in his organization for some odd reason. Could it have just been a coincidence? Odell's case history is an interesting one. In 1956, he was asked to testify before the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee about his communist activities. He took the Fifth Amendment when questioned. In 1958, the same thing occurred. In 1962, the House Committee on Un-American Activities had a report published. The report was called Structure and Organization of the Communist Party in the United States. On page 576 of this report, the names of the people who were elected to the National Committee of the Communist Party USA were listed. Hunter Pitts Odell was on the list. Odell's credentials are disturbing. In 1956, Odell was district organizer for the Communist Party in New Orleans, Louisiana, was still a member of the Communist Party when Martin Luther King Jr. hired him. And while King was paying Odell, was elected to the National Committee of the Communist Party. The St. Louis Globe Democrat had an article that exposed King for hiring the communist Odell on October 26, 1962. King, wishing to prevent the false image that he tried so diligently to convey from being destroyed, claimed to have fired Odell. Later, it was discovered that Odell went to work for the administrator of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the SCLC, the organization of which King was president in New York. The press discovered this apparent mistake on King's part that was made again, which caused King to fire Odell again on June 26, 1963. In July of 1963, a reporter working for the UPI, that's United Press International, phoned the New York office of the SCLC. Much to the reporter's stupefaction, he was told that Odell was still administrator of that office. Odell has also worked for Jesse Jackson. After it was revealed that Odell was a communist, King continued to secretly work with him. Together, Odell and King worked on what they called Project C. They said that the C, this is the letter C, stood for Confrontation Birmingham. Later, they developed the Birmingham Manifesto, which outlined their plans in Project C. Members of the SCLC distributed it to people in the Birmingham community to create tension. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference has an interesting history. Its title, called Southern Christian Leadership Conference, is an oxymoron because the leadership given by that group is hardly Christian. King was, of course, king of the organization. Fred Shuttlesworth became second in command, the vice president. Reverend Andrew Young was appointed as the program director. Now, I believe many of you should recall the name Andrew Young. There was something unusual about Young's bedfellows. Young had been allowed to stay for free in Savannah and was given an office at the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers while there. Amazing, all these organizations. Perhaps the union liked having a reverend around, or there might have been another reason why he was allowed to stay there without having to pay rent. Perhaps, just lost my spot here, without having to pay rent. Perhaps certain ideas and plans shared in common was the real reason. He had been trained at the Highlander Folk School, the Subversive Activities Control Board, which was an agency of the federal government, discovered the union to be communist infiltrated. During a raid of the SCEF by the state and local police of New Orleans, besides discovering communist literature, a few things were discovered about King's SCLC. A photograph of King with the known communist Dombrowski and the Bradens, which had been taken at an annual meeting of the SCLC, was discovered. Letters from King to Dombrowski and the Bradens were found. King and Dombrowski were good friends. King even filed an affidavit that supported James Dombrowski and the SCEF in New Orleans. When King was shown proof by the Joint Legislative Committee on Un-American Activities that Dombrowski was indeed a communist, King said that he was still fond of Dombrowski. The committee noted that King had no change in his endorsement of Dombrowski. Dr. King refused to repudiate the affidavit. King and Dombrowski even corresponded regularly. In one letter that King wrote, their cordial relationship is clearly shown. And I'm going to read this portion here. It says, "Dear Jim, this is just a note to acknowledge the receipt of your letter of recent date. We, too, were more than happy to have you in our home. The fellowship was very rewarding. I will expect to hear from you when Bishop Love returns to the country. At that time, we can set the date for an Atlanta meeting. Very sincerely yours, Martin." In the letter. The Bradens, Carl and Ann, a couple of whites who associated with King quite frequently, have an interesting history together in the Communist Party. It seems that Carl Braden was once convicted of conspiring to bomb someone's house. You would think that he would plan to bomb a right-winger's house or one of those ultra-evil, vile, bigoted, hate-mongering racists who are made from snake snails and puppy dog tails and occasionally froth at the mouth, as we are told. But it turns out just the opposite. Braden was convicted of conspiring with African-Americans to bomb the house of a black and then place the blame on white segregationists. It seems that Carl Braden was trying to pick a racial war with the hope that his socialist ideology would be espoused by the American society in response to it. King was very friendly with the Bradens. On October 7, 1958, in a letter to Anne Braden from King, King's friendliness towards her was distinctly noted. In the letter, said Jack Rogers of the Joint Legislative Committee on Un-American Activities, quote, King urges Anne Braden and her husband Carl, both Communist Party members, to become permanently associated with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Of course, the Bradens were well identified publicly as communists long before the date of this letter, quote, unquote. In the letter, King also thanked Carl Braden for attending a committee. Anne Braden was once indicted for sedition by the state of Kentucky. When King's SCLC had an event, his comrades would often speak as well. In Birmingham, Alabama, at the 6th Annual Conference of the SCLC, September 25th through 28th, 1962, Anne Braden, Carl Braden, and James Dombrowski, who were all identified as communists, spoke. As you will soon see, there was more than just guilt by association. King was up to his earlobes in subversive activities. King often claimed that he was just expressing his love for everyone. And as King said, to protect himself, anyone who disagreed was obviously just a hateful racist. Perhaps there was some truth in some cases to King's claim that racists disliked him. However, that does not make his activities any less excusable. When J. Edgar Hoover told the House Appropriations Committee that there were communists in the civil rights movement, King said that it was a lie. King even said that Hoover has allowed himself to aid and abet the fallacious claim of Southern racists and extreme right-wing elements. We are told that we can trust King, who is usually portrayed as the honest, loving, caring, modern-day martyred messiah, more than Hoover, the white man who, as a consequence of being white, as we are regularly told, is innately a racist and who worked for the oppressive government of the United States. King would sometimes meet with foreign groups. Senator Strom Thurmond, Republican of South Carolina, knew of King's links with foreign groups. When King and another one of his friends, Ralph Abernathy, were arrested in 1963, Senator Thurmond described who they were. He described them as two American Negro agitators who were recently arrested in Birmingham, Alabama. Their names are Martin Luther King Jr. and Reverend Ralph D. Abernathy. These two men are expert professional riot makers. They have been in contact with advisors in direct links with the Soviet secret police or the KGB and extreme African groups operating from Europe. Of course, King did much more than meet with American communists and occasionally write letters. He often participated in marches with them. The communists, along with King's black power advocates, would always rally behind King, often traveling far distances to see King. By the communists and others always traveling to be with King, they would be able to make a statement to the effect that they were a force with which to be reckoned, and they would be ready to meet any problem that they would encounter. It is true that there is strength in numbers, and King knew this, as did his colleagues. Attending anti-American demonstrations was quite common for King. One of King's associates, Reverend James Bevel, had a demonstration in New York Central Park in the UN Plaza. During the demonstration, King spoke. American flags burned. In 1958, Martin Luther King Jr. was operating as the co-chairman of the militant group Youth March, along with a veteran supporter of Communist Fronts, A. Philip Randolph. The communist newspaper called the Daily Worker reported the march, saying, large number of the left forces actively aided in mobilizing support for the youth march and were in vast audience. Communist publication Challenge noted that the marchers, White House student delegation leader, and 14 of the main youth organizers were members of the Young People's Socialist League. King participated in a march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama in 1964. U.S. Representative William Dickinson described the four groups of people who attended. He said that one group was the Alabama Negro, who participated to secure rights and privileges. The second group was described as do-gooders, people who had good intentions but were misguided. Another group was described as human flotsam, adventurers, beatniks, prostitutes, and similar rabble. And the fourth group, who was accredited with organizing the others, was, in Congressman Dickinson's words, the Communist Party. King spoke at the march in Montgomery, and some other people spoke as well. The communist Carl Braden, Abner Barry, a director of the Communist Party, James Peck, a criminal with a lengthy federal record who once attempted to stop the launching of the U.S.'s first nuclear submarine, and Bayard Rustin, a self-admitted Communist Party organizer for 12 years. Today, people are expected to believe that it must have been mere coincidence that all the communists spoke at the same rally as King. After all, as we are so often told, King could not have been a communist. On August 29, 1967, the National Conference for New Politics began its convention. Almost every single subversive organization in America, the Socialist Workers' Party, Progressive Labor Party, W.E.B., Du Bois clubs, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Draft Resistors Union, Revolutionary Action Movement, and of course, the Communist Party USA attended the convention. Members of King's SCLC made sure that they attended too. After all, King was the keynote speaker. Along with the usual communist rantings, there were some anti-white chants of kill Whitey, which were heard at the convention King attended. During the convention, some violence occurred. One representative was slugged on the head with a bottle, a Communist Party leader's son and another person were robbed at knife point. I'm going to go ahead and take another quick break here, and I'll be right back. Why does the doctor Freddy. I'm back. Pick up where we left off. Many communists supported Martin Luther King Jr. Michael Lasky, who was the chairman of the Communist Party USA, noted King's alleged allegiance. Lasky said that King was secretive about his relationship with the Communist Party USA. On April 13, 1967, Lasky told a press conference this, quote, "King knows what's going on. He is allowing himself to be utilized by the Communist Party. King willingly enters into an alliance with the Communist Party. Mr. King receives support from organizations and individuals that are tied to the Communist Party. He knows what is happening, and so does James Bevel." Close quote. Gus Hall, a renowned communist, said that the leaders of the Communist Party USA consult with and advise Negro leaders in their civil rights campaigns. Members of the Communist Party are very active in all the Negro organizations engaged in the civil rights struggle, said Gus. And he was right. Of course, King vehemently denied it to the general public, knowing what would happen to his hidden agenda if he were to admit his affiliation with the Communist Party. In one speech, Martin Luther King Jr. said, "I am sick and tired of people saying movement has been infiltrated by communists and communist sympathizers." He was referring to the civil rights movement. "There are as many communists in this freedom movement as there are Eskimos in Florida. There must have been quite a few Eskimos getting sunburnt on Florida's beaches at the time of King's speech. Other than the organizations and people previously cited, the NAACP seemed to have quite a few subversives working. For instance, John Wesley Dobbs, who was the national vice president of the NAACP about the time that King was talking about the Eskimos, also happened to be on board of directors of the SCEF. Dobbs signed an amica, that's goddamn Latin, C-U-I-R-I-A-E, basically a document intended to aid the court's proceeding. Okay, Dobbs signed a brief to the U.S. Supreme Court on behalf of the Communist Party in the fall of 1955. The NAACP has been filled with subversive anti-American people, according to evidence adduced by the Florida Investigation Committee, the FIC. That is not to say that everyone who was a member of the NAACP was a communist. Certainly some had honorable intentions, but were merely misguided. The FIC listed the communist affiliations of the NAACP's top members. Apparently, the NAACP's letterhead in the past listed 236 of its national officers. The great majority of the NAACP's national officers have been involved with communist enterprises. Altogether, the national officers curtailed membership in a staggering 2,200 communist enterprises, which averages out to more than 9 per name. When King needed support, it came from more than just the NAACP, which was discovered to be filled with subversives. A meeting was held by the Emergency Committee to support Birmingham in an effort to support King's tactics in Birmingham. The principal speaker was Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth. Some of the other speakers were James Farmer of the Congress of Racial Equality and Malcolm X. Now, Congress of Racial Equality is CORE. Now, what is CORE? Much like the NAACP, it appears that the purpose of CORE for some of its members has never been honorable. However, it must be noted that even in CORE, there have been people whose intentions were good but have been manipulated by others. The purpose of CORE was best summarized by former Senator Eastland. "This organization," quote, "this organization is a war department of those who sell hate, collect donations, and sow the seeds of discord in this country. Since its inception, its creed has been lawlessness, and its tactics have followed the pattern set by communist agitation the world over," end quote. King vehemently denied ever having been a communist, just as many others of that lost cause did. However, his claim, reportedly, did not fool the people in the government who were investigating King's involvement. According to the black newspaper columnist Carl Rowan, who had attended National Security Council meetings and who was allowed to access confidential FBI files on King that have since been sealed, King was known to be a communist since May of 1962. When King's name was placed in Section A of this report, tabbed Communist, in the FBI's files, Bill Sullivan, diligently working for J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, determined that, at the time, King was the most dangerous Negro of the future in this nation from the standpoint of communism, the Negro, and national security. If King's communist activities were known as early as 1962, if not before, by the FBI, a logical question should naturally follow. Why do not more people know about it? The answer is simple. In order to prevent recurring violence, something that the majority of peace-loving Americans detests, a lid was put on King's sordid actions. The Department of Justice had a special task force appointed to determine what to do with King's FBI files. Knowing full well that a King holiday would not be condoned or tolerated by any sensible white person after reviewing the evidence amassed by the FBI, and probably wishing to prevent a riot, the special task force articulated this on January 11, 1977. Quote, "The Federal Bureau of Investigation Surveillance produced tapes and transcripts concerning King and many others. These may be sought by King's heirs and representatives. Worse still, they may be sought by members of the public at large under the Freedom of Information Act. We recommend that these tapes and transcripts be sealed and sent to the National Archives, and that the Congress be asked to pass legislation denying anyone access to them, whatever, and authorizing and directing their total destruction, along with the destruction of material in reports and memoranda derived from them," end quote. A mere 3 weeks after the investigation was concluded by the Department of Justice's task force, U.S. District Judge John Lewis Smith, Jr. ordered that the FBI should file with the National Archives all of the FBI tapes and documents growing out of the wiretaps, buggings, and other surveillances of King, and that the materials regarding King not be made public for at least 50 years, except by court order. 50 years, that is a long time to wait. If the current falsehoods surrounding King have been instituted in about 2.5 decades, the time between his assassination and now, it is perturbing to consider how much more can be hidden and distorted in a little more than 3 decades, the time between now and when the ban ends. We are expected to wait for more than 30 years for King's files. It is interesting to note that our government felt that things would be worse if the public were allowed access to documents that, by all rights, people should be allowed to view under the Freedom of Information Act. It almost seems as if some people in the government were attempting to hide something from their constituents, the very people that they are supposed to serve. That is simply intolerable. Fortunately, the congressional record is not sealed, so more forthcoming evidence taken from the excerpts of it shall be shown in order to conclusively prove the true agenda of Martin Luther King, Jr. The truth shall set us free, free at last. It is difficult to tell exactly when Martin Luther King Jr. became affiliated with subversives. It probably began sometime in college, perhaps when he joined the Dialectical Society. While King attended Morehouse College in Atlanta, he had a cordial relationship with Benjamin Mays, who purportedly had an extensive record of support of communist fronts and causes. Regardless of when King first became affiliated with his communist cohorts, he eventually curtailed membership in or was affiliated with over 60 communist groups or people before he was killed. The fact was made known by an affidavit issued by Carl Prussian, an FBI counter-spy from 1947 to 1960, which was inserted into the congressional record. Prussian promulgated that several members of the NAACP and CORE, including Martin Luther King Jr., were affiliated with communist activities. Before I read what he stated, let me take a drag off of this cigarette and get a drink. Okay. He stated the following. I, Carl Prussian, solemnly state that at each and every meeting of five meetings he attended sponsored by the Communist Party, one Ed Beck, communist, who is presently secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or the NAACP, of San Mateo County, California, and a member of the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, C-O-R-E, presented the directive from the district office of the Communist Party in San Francisco to the effect that, quote, all communists working within the framework of the NAACP are instructed to work for a change of the passive attitude of the NAACP toward a more militant, demonstrative class struggle policy to be expressed by sit-ins, demonstrations, marches, and protests for the purpose of transforming the NAACP into an organization for the achievement of the communist objective, close quote. I further swear and attest to the fact that at each and every one of these aforementioned meetings, one Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was always set forth as the individual to whom communists should look and rally around in the communist struggle on the many racial issues. I hereby also state that Martin Luther King Jr. has either been a member of or willingly accepted support from over 60 communist fronts, individuals, and or organizations which gave aid to or espoused communist causes, end quote. So, King was affiliated with over 60 communist fronts, individuals, and or organizations, quite a few. Carl Prussian produced a documentary report on Martin Luther King Jr. also. In it, he listed some of the communists who were King's comrades. It is interesting to note that those types of organizations oftentimes attempt to hide their hideous agenda by having a name that sounds respectable, as mentioned earlier. The asinine attempts by certain groups to deny Martin Luther King Jr. had been affiliated with many communist organizations are contradictory to the evidence. For brevity's sake, all the subversive groups or people who were affiliated with King are not mentioned. According to Prussian's report, King was affiliated with the following subversives on this list, and I'm going to list 16 of them here. Number one, the Ad Hoc Committee on the Eisenhower-Khrushchev Talks to Explore the Requirements of Peace. He was a member. Number two, War Resisters League. He was a speaker at the 36th Annual Dinner. Number three, the Highland Folk School. He was speaker at the 25th anniversary celebration on September 2, 1957. Number four, Manifesto Against Passage of New Sedition Laws by the States. He was a signer. Number five, the International Workers Order. Number six, the Southern Conference Educational Fund. Number seven, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, a member of Advisory Council, editor, contributor. Number eight, the Daily Worker, which is a newspaper. Number nine, People's World, which is also a newspaper. Number 10, the National Advisory Committee of the Congress of Racial Equality. Number 11, the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee. Number 12, Petition to Congress to Eliminate House Un-American Activities Committee. He was a signer. Number 13, a petition to President Kennedy, a signer, denouncing the House Un-American Activities Committee and the Senate International Security Subcommittee, who were both uncovering his affiliations with subversive groups. Number 14, Braden Clemency Appeal. He was an initiator of a petition asking for clemency for Carl Braden, a convicted field secretary of the Southern Conference Educational Fund and letter soliciting signers of petition dated June 7th, 1961. Number 15, I believe that's some sort of publication because it's in italics. It's called Liberation. He was a writer for, and it lists March 28th, 1961 as a date. Number 16, the Communist Party. Prussian listed a few of King's communist cohorts, too. Prussian said that the following were communist associates of King. One A.J. Muste, a Harry Bridges, a Pete Seeger, Aubrey Williams, W.E.B. Du Bois, Abner Barry, Bayard Rustin, Ben Davis, Gus Hall, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, and Rufus E. Clement. Prussian was quick to point out at a striking point, quote, since King has not rejected the support, but rather encourages and welcomes it, of individuals, publications, and organizations that give aid and comfort to the revolutionary communist objectives, he necessarily becomes an integral part of it, end quote. When King's communist cohorts were arrested, he came to their aid. King endorsed a petition to free Carl Braden, who was convicted for being the communist field secretary of the Southern Conference Educational Fund. He signed a plea to have Junius Scales freed. Scales was the leader of North Carolina's Communist Party, was one of the few people convicted under the membership clause of the Smith Act. King tried to get Scales pardoned, hoping that President Kennedy would be sympathetic towards Scales' desire to destroy America. Morton Sobel, a convicted atom bomb spy, was another fellow that King led on an appeal to free. King even went to the extent of joining the National Committee to Secure Justice for Morton Sobel for the convicted traitor. Obviously, King's allegiance was never to the nation which he lived. King's relationship with communists was a two-way street. When King was arrested, his communist friends quickly came to his rescue. Gus Hall, General Secretary of the Communist Party USA, Benjamin Davis, Secretary of the Communist Party USA, protested the arrest of King in wires to President Eisenhower, said the published communist publication called The Daily Worker on October 30th, 1960. The government was never too concerned about King's activities other than finding out what he was doing. Although the United States government has made laws denouncing communism in the past, most of the laws were useless. An excellent example of this is the Internal Security Act of 1950, and better yet, the Communist Control Act of 1954. The Internal Security Act of 1950 created to keep the government aware of subversive groups operating in the United States was declared wrong on the basis of technicalities. Although the government could find the subversives, the courts merely slapped the subversive hands and said, see you later. During a discussion of the Internal Security Act in Congress, the reason for it being struck down in 1967 was explained. Quote, the Internal Security Act of 1950 finally received its death blow recently when the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia determined that the Communist Party could not be made to register because to do so would violate the privilege against self-incrimination of the individuals who would register for the party. This is some 17 years after the act was passed, with the major purpose of getting the Communist Party to register as a communist action group. As yet, no organization has registered under the provisions of that act. End quote. What good are laws if there is not any compliance or enforcement of them? Apparently, the government must have thought that the Communist Party would be cooperative working with them. Members of the Communist Party, or any subversive organization for that matter, would never willingly admit that the purpose was to destroy the United States. People are not that stupid. In another revealing comment, Congress discussed why the Communist Control Act in 1954 was never used. Quote, The Communist Control Act of 1954 has never been implemented because no one knows what it means, and the executive branch of the government has been unwilling to try to enforce it in any way, end quote. Since the government would not enforce its own laws, was too busy fighting other branches or political parties, or simply did not know or care what its laws meant, Martin Luther King Jr. was allowed to walk unscathed with nothing to fear from the members of the government who were bickering over trivialities. When he began his campaign to undermine the government, especially during the Vietnam War, he was met with little resistance. The permissive attitude of the American government when it comes to dealing with subversive minority groups may be its undoing. The Vietnam War was, in my opinion, only second to the Civil War as being the most divisive war in U.S. history. Protesters fought supporters in the streets. Both the pro-war and anti-war sides made massive propaganda campaigns. If you voice dissent, you will be associated with leftists, although that was not always the case. Not all the people who were against the Vietnam War were dishonorable. During the Vietnam protests, there were three main groups who were quite vocal. The first group was those people who were leftists and were against the war. They opposed the war to such an extent that their protests of the war often resulted in violent opposition. The second group was peace-loving American citizens and nationalists who were against the war. The third group was the people who believed in America, right or wrong, and followed the government's orders without question. Briefly examine the three main groups operating during the Vietnam War. Number one, there were, without any question, many subversives who were working against American soldiers stationed overseas. They wanted the mental illness of communism to spread all over the world. They despised America's attempts to help prevent the spread of communism. The subversives were the ones pitying what happened to the evil communists operating in Hanoi. These people would not enlist, and when drafted, would not serve. If they were forced to participate, they would get out with some type of excuse. This was a group who said good riddance when American soldiers died. They would lie about the war just to make America look bad. When the war was finally over, this group contained the dregs of society who spat on the returning soldiers. Oftentimes, members of this group would attempt to masquerade as the second group, disguising their true intentions. Number two, there were many decent concerned citizens who were against the war. Understandably, some felt that although it was honorable for the government to stop the spread of communism, it was not the United States' job to act as the world's policeman. These people felt that America should focus on problems here in our nation rather than problems half the world away. Many of these people were against the government sacrificing Americans' children for the benefit of Vietnam. Generally speaking, this group was not involved in the protests. These people would not enlist, but when they were asked to serve, they would go, but with serious reservations. Number three, some people believe that whatever our government did, it was right. The people in this group may have opposed the war acts initially, but once the war was in full force and people were being drafted, they had to support the war. Many of these people enlisted. Others in this group served with little hesitation when drafted. They would rather die than risk their honor or appear to be sympathetic to the evil people in the first group. They were this nation's warriors, these patriots who were always ready to fight on behalf of America's actions. I'm going to take a drink and light a cigarette. Hold on just one. Okay, we're getting real close to ending the show. It's clear I'm not going to be able to end this tonight, and it'll have to pick up on the next one. And we'll just have to see how far it goes into it. But I'm going to find a stopping point here, and then go ahead and play a song. I'm going to read you know a little bit more here before I call it quits. I'm not going to do it just right away here. So. Anyway, in 1965, amid controversy surrounding Vietnam, Martin Luther King Jr. was at the forefront of those opposing the war. There is no question that he belonged to the first group, those who were sympathetic to the communists in North Vietnam, the Viet Cong. Under the pretense of pacifism and nonviolence, he said that he opposed the war. However, his allegiance with Hanoi and its communist leadership were something that he had difficulty explaining to those who could see through his smokescreen. King revealed his plans in a discussion with the black militant Stokely Carmichael. King told Carmichael that he wanted to help our Viet Cong comrades in arms by disrupting American cities. Roland Evans and Robert Novak, both of whom were prominent newspaper columnists at the time, noticed King associating with Carmichael of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. Evans and Novak were quick to point out that King had surrendered valuable ground to the leftist extremists in their desire for control of the civil rights movement. Also, they were, unless King breaks with the SNCC extremists, liberal whites may longer follow his leadership. They were right. Some of King's followers, most of whom belonged to the first or second group, followed King's lead. Senator Strom Thurmond stated his displeasure with King's attempts to influence people in international affairs. Senator Thurmond felt that King had no right to engage in international affairs. Senator Thurmond described King's activities as, quote, "A whole new sphere of troublemaking for the United States was launched yesterday when Martin Luther King Jr., accompanied by Bayard Rustin, turned from his successes at creating domestic orders to an attempt to play the same role with similar consequences in international affairs. Neither King nor Rustin have backgrounds or experiences which would entitle them to an official audience. King is a notorious troublemaker and intermeddler who has of late publicly revealed his interest in international affairs. Only King and possibly some agencies of the government can be sure what qualifications he possesses or thinks he possesses, which would make persuasive his proposals to the leaders of communism to whom he proposes next to address." Close quote. King said that if America were to take further steps against the communists in Vietnam, it may be necessary to engage in civil disobedience. Instead of protesting the bloodshed and tyranny perpetrated by the Viet Cong, he condemned America, the very nation that was trying to bring justice and equality to Vietnam. Evidently, King's wife, Coretta Scott King, must have felt the same way. She accompanied a delegation of women to Hanoi. The late black Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall lambasted King for his anti-Vietnam tactics. If King is trying to align the civil rights struggle with Vietnam, said Marshall, he is leading the movement in the wrong direction. I do not believe he speaks for the majority of civil rights leaders or the majority of Negroes. It is quite amusing to read King's rantings about communism. Although he often tried to make it sound as if he denounced communism, he fully supported it. Since he advocated the support of communism, his strategy of denouncing it verbally, when in front of the public audience basically, but supporting it physically worked brilliantly. That is why communist groups always supported him. In one speech, he actually condemned communism, possibly with the hope that it would vindicate him from any wrongdoing. Further, by delivering a speech filled with such double talk, he ostensibly gave loyal Americans who would not tolerate his activities if they knew what his hidden agenda truly was, the feeling that he was also loyal and merely misunderstood. In one speech, King promulgated, quote, "We must not call everyone a communist or an appeaser who advocates the seating of Red China in the United Nations, and who recognizes the hate and hysteria are not the final answers to the problem of these turbulent days. We must not engage in a negative anti-communism, rather in a positive thrust for democracy, realizing that our greatest defense against communism is to take action in behalf of justice. We must, with positive action, seek to remove those conditions of poverty, insecurity, and injustice, which are the fertile soil in which communism grows and develops." End quote. I'm going to cough here. King was obviously, I'm sorry, King was absolving himself from actions. King openly supported Red China's admissions to the UN, and that is why he did not want people calling everyone a communist or an appeaser who advocates the seating of Red China in the UN. And anyone that disagreed with him was simply full of hate and hysteria, not sound reasoning. King claimed, King said that Americans should not engage in a negative anti-communism. That's what it said, and that's in quotes. Although the wording is basically a double negative, similar to that of a child saying, I don't want no food. His message is quite clear. People should not criticize communists. Much like a fox running through a stream to rid itself of a scent so that the dogs would not catch it, King was hoping to befuddle his enemies, not communists, non-militants, and non-activists, in other words, people who work for a living, and enlist their aid. Contrary to King's thesis, America was engaged in a positive thrust for democracy, and it was King who wanted the communist government in Vietnam left alone. And in America, he wanted his own brand of positive action to be administered to end the disparities in our nation, namely more government intervention to be administered at his discretion. As King continued his speech out of the same breath, he stated, quote, these are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression, and out of the wombs of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries, end quote. And we'll find a good place to stop here. King constantly complained that both he and his cohorts were exploited and oppressed. He was trying to get something across, perhaps a threat to American culture, which he suggested that men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. It is amusing how he stated, we in the West. Earlier in his diatribe, King stated that America fell victim to the deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long. Ironically, several paragraphs later in his speech, he felt that he was part of this same deadly Western arrogance. Okay, that looks like a good stopping point. So, I'll go ahead and close with my usual points here. Let's see, I lost them in my notes. There we go. So again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Odin demands that you grow the fuck up. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. 1488, so until next time, hail Satan, and I'm going to pick a song to go out with. We'll be right back.
Teller.
Satan!